What Global have done with that network has been phenomenal. This was a pinnacle of my career. I'd been working towards this all of my career. Jeff was promised a Porsche if he went to number one.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Dirk Anthony.
I came into the world in Tasmania. It was small country Australia, but it's an island mentality. It's a place that's the same size as the Republic of Ireland. It's got 500,000 people, so there's a lot of space. And my parents were European migrants. They were the Dutch equivalent of 10-pound Poms. My dad was an electrician, so I had one of those little cardboard things that he bought for a birthday where you got little springs and you put the wires from one wire to another, and I made my first radio. But I remember having a little earpiece, a little old tan-looking earpiece that you could hear the crackle of the local radio station in Devonport, Tasmania, through this little hobby kit that my dad had bought me. Then I had a DJ deck, two Technics turntables, the real deal. That was the sort of, I had access to them through my father, and he was a real audiophile. He loved music. He had the very best hi-fi needles. We didn't have a lot of money, but there was certainly, that's where he spent some money on that. Great speakers. So I suppose you'd say that influence, I've not really thought about how much of an influence that had. It was just something that I understood. But I got to an age where I realised that I didn't want to follow the traditional. I was a carpenter for 4 years. I did my apprenticeship and realised that that's not what I wanted to do. But it was in the days in the sort of 70s where, in those sort of markets, it would be the local family that owned the radio station, and whoever had the most power, usually the parents, would decide what the music policy was. My sister was going out with the station manager, as it happened, coincidentally. It is a small town, after all. She said, oh, my brother is a DJ in a nightclub, and he'd love to do this. So I started, I just went in and did sort of the buy, trade, and sell. I was the guy that said, this is for sale for this much. And that sort of petered out. And then the guy said, well, there is a copywriting job going in a big station in Launceston, a town down the road. Well, I'm not doing copyright, I'm not writing commercials. I'm a DJ. And he said, do you want to get into radio or not? So off I tottled and started writing commercials. It was an entree into radio, but it was also through the commercial reality of what it takes. And I can remember very much taking a written commercial, produced commercial on a cassette player to the local opticians and walking into his shop saying, I've got a commercial that I've got to play for you. And he said, get out of my shop, I haven't got time to listen to that. Which made me realise the life of a salesperson, having to deal with customers and deal with clients who actually find advertising a necessary evil on local radio.
Take a look around, you'll see that the Meyer Bargain Basement is the place you should be.
Ladies, it's bonus bargain week right now in the Meyer Bargain.
Well, from that post, I did as most people do. I hung around. Somebody didn't turn up to do a shift. I got a chance to go into the studio and do a show. I remember trying to put the needle onto the. That's how old I am. It was the end of that era, but put the needle on, and I was shaking. My hand was shaking so much. It took two hands to get it on there without causing any problems. So, like most people who started in radio, you're around, and when somebody falls over or doesn't turn up or is sick or whatever, you're the last person standing, and you'll say, "Yeah, sure, I can do that." I then got a full-time show. I still, in those days, and probably still in small radio stations around the world, you do two jobs. You do an on-air shift and you do some other things. I stopped copywriting. I started doing more production for on-air, so writing promos and things like that. I did an afternoon show. I then did a bit of a night show. And then we had a very big talent on Breakfast. He moved to another stage, to the station across the road, and they put me together with a female partner, and she was the star. I was the sort of the jock, and she was the well-known star. It was the Dirk and Judy show. We had 4.5 years, and it was one of the early sort of male-female shows. But it was interesting because it was very much she was the star. So, fast forward to today's world, when I was working with male and female breakfast shows, there was always the debate who's the star. And I worked in a show for 4.5 years where the female was the star. So you go fast forward to Joe and Twiggy in the days of in Trent, and you know, Joe was the star, and lots of conversations with Twiggy to say this is that doesn't mean that, but it's you're both playing, and of course that became much more balanced over time.
We'll send you a video of the movie of your choice on Hollywood on Helium Online 5, Sue.
Hello.
So I was always pretty comfortable with, you know, who's who in the zoo and those sorts of conversations, having been there myself in the early days. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was doing a job that I've always wanted to do. Of course, there were things that were difficult, and I didn't get what I wanted to get when I wanted it and things like that. However, I was in a career that I really wanted, and I was extremely ambitious. So I was in a small market with a level of authority because I'd been there a long time. I had some influence over decision-making, and I was learning at the same time. So for me, you know, that was fantastic. So after about 8 years, I realised that I wanted to, you know, as most people do, they want to go to the big market. You know, all eyes are on Melbourne or Sydney, just like all eyes are on sort of London.
I like the touch.
However, because I was doing such a great job in the market that I was in, the owners of the big Melbourne station, well, why would we take him out of there to put him into a smaller job here, when, because, you know, that has a big influence on the outcome of the business performance. So I was in a difficult place, but I had a fantastic general manager of that radio station who helped me when he realized that I'd sort of done my time. He helped me work with the consultants to find another job somewhere else. And an opportunity came up in Dublin, and the guy was Bill Clements, Peter Don from BPR, who were our research and programming consultants, said, would you fancy going over to Dublin? I said, yes, before I really thought about it. So, and of course, the troubles, you know, were still on. This was early 90s. You know, when you live in Tasmania, which is as far away from Dublin as probably just about anywhere, all you hear about are the terrible difficulties of that part of the world. Well, certainly north. But it was an opportunity. So I went to work with Jeff O'Brien as the program director, and Dennis O'Brien, who's is obviously now well known as a billionaire entrepreneur. And Dennis had a radio station in Dublin called 98FM. They were looking to buy other radio stations in Europe, and they needed some people who've got experience. So what people like me could provide them was a level of experience in a competitive market, together with, you know, a need to sort of grow in with bigger toys and train sets. So the benefit for me was to work with bigger budgets and bigger talent. For them, they had somebody who's experienced in commercial and a level of drive that was difficult to find in a market that had always been, at that stage, relatively benign. Ego comes through. I didn't want to be the deputy or the assistant program director, so I opted for the operations manager title, which is, I look back now going, you know, where was your head? Because I was coming to do the OE, the big overseas experience, for 2 years and go back to a bigger job in Australia.
Classic hits, 98FM, morning to you. It's Mark Cagney here. That's REM, Find the River. Got to get you into my life, the Beatles before that.
In effect, I was the deputy to Jeff O'Brien, the deputy program director. But as Dennis bought a new radio station in Prague, also called 98FM, all the managers went over to set that up. You know, I was running the ship. So I was there doing the doing while the guys were off finding new territories. It was an opportunity. So I got to work with some very senior people. And one of the parts of my career where I learnt the most around attitude and approach to work, I mean, we worked for Dennis O'Brien, who then was not a billionaire, who is now. You need to have a level of get up and go. I was climbing up the sides of buildings with no safety harness, along with my colleagues, putting up 98FM logos for a big U2 concert, because we were masters at hijacking the concerts that the RTE had paid lots of money to sponsor. Dennis did not know no. I learned a lot about drive and determination and from that experience. It was tough, but it was very, very good.
See the stone set in your eyes. See the thorn twist in your side.
Well, of course, with the benefit of hindsight and some seriously thick goggles, what I was good at was being clear about what I wanted. What I was rubbish at was having any empathy for what that might be like, hearing that. So, look, you know, there's no question that you're driven by getting a result. So, you know, I'm very aware that being results orientated, you focus on results much more than you probably – there's a balance. You've got to have results, but you've got to work out then how you're going to get there, which is sort of a second phase of my career. But at the time, there was no question it was about – what are the results and what have we got to do to get there? The guys, if they ever get around to listening to this, will either go, that's complete bollocks, or that's right. But I think it's much more about being clear then and I would have played the Australian card a lot more because the Irish weren't interested in the English perspective on radio. But there was a begrudging respect for the Australian markets and the American markets simply because they had been dealing with direct competition for a lot longer. So there's a personal approach, which, you know, we've just been talking about, and then there's the sort of context of where you come from, where the level of credibility. So at the time, one of the areas where, you know, talking about, you say yes first and, you know, pedal like hell below the surface was around research, because I knew about research and I'd worked with, you know, great research consultants. But when you're in a bigger market, you're expected to know absolutely every minute detail about research. So there was a fairly steep learning curve around the nuances of the research, because you're making decisions that had big impacts on where the station goes.
Good morning to you.
The station went to number one, and it shouldn't have done. A quirk of the survey, and Jeff was promised a Porsche if he went to number one. And this is against RTE. This would be like Talk Sport beating Radio 4. And one survey, we did it. It was an amazing. We were doing a fantastic job breaking new ground. So audience, you know, we knew our research was supporting the rate, but it was a quirk. It was, as we all know, when you get a good one, you take it, you bank it, because we'll all feel the pain when we get a bad one. He didn't get a Porsche because even he said, I can't take a Porsche. Because I know in 3 months we're going to get another survey. So he got a beautiful BMW two-door coupe, which I picked up from the showroom because he was off somewhere swanning about on holidays or something. So, and I remember picking it up because it was such a cool car, and I'd never driven a BMW before. And I drove it from the showroom to his apartment in Black Rock in Dublin, and I parked it up beautifully. It was shiny. It was perfect. And I walked away with the keys in my hand. And as I turned around, a seagull shat on the bonnet, and I had to go back and clean this damn bonnet of bird shit. But we were in a basement of a Georgian townhouse. You don't need fancy digs. You just got to have the right attitude, the right drive, and some good strategic thinking.
98 FM.
2 years there, I knew that I wanted to run my own ship. I had met Steve Orchard and heard about GWR through a BPR consulting sort of, we had a seminar on research, and I met Steve at the bar, and through a if I can remember correctly, through a beer filled evening, I said, I'd like to come work for you. I'd heard a bit about them, I'd watched them, and I could see that they were really trying to grow, and they'd been through the recession of the early 90s, and, you know, obviously clearly great talent in managers and leaders, but like most smaller businesses, you know, the level of leadership goes so far, and then you've got to really try and beef up your middle management. And their programmers were on the air, and they were flat out busy. And in order for them to really make a change, they just started the Better Music Mix about a year before. It was working, but how did they develop that? So I could see there was an opportunity for me. Clearly, they couldn't put me on the air because the accent, although subsequently there was a number of Aussies on the air, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do. So they had to then find the money to have their first off-air program controller, which seemed like a huge thing for them. So it took Steve 6 months, much pestering from me, many, many phone calls. and in the end, long story short, he and Ralph hired me, and I started in Bristol.
GWR-FM.
They didn't actually tell the incumbent in the role at the time that I was coming along, so that meant I sat in a rental for about 2 or 3 weeks while they sort of worked out how they were going to tell this person. So anyway, it turned out to be the beginning of a very, very successful partnership all round with a lot of people involved. Steve and I think, worked very well together because we understood each other, but we were very different. But he was an extremely tolerant and intelligent manager and leader of people. Four stations, Bristol, Swindon, Reading and Bournemouth. And about 3 months into my tenure, they'd bought Nottingham, and they didn't take BR&B on, but they had Nottingham, Leicester, and I went up to Nottingham and worked with Rob Wagstaff and various other guys there. And I realized that what I was suggesting Rob do and the guys there do, because then we're trying to work at who was who and who was going to do what. And we started to put a format in place, the GWR Bible. I thought, well, I should actually be doing that in my own station in Bristol, because I had been making some changes, but not to the same degree, because I was in the room. Trent FM became the sort of the beginning of my involvement with GWR on a group level beyond the work that I was doing with GWR FM in Bristol. I think if I'm being really honest, I just would have thought, well, I've been brought here to bring some expertise, and there wasn't a lot. However, of course, I look back and think, well, that's just plainly ridiculous, because there was a lot of intelligence. I just didn't see it. So this was more about me and my inability to be able to see, because I was so focused on what I was doing. When we sort of suggested, look, here's an approach which gives clarity to the audience, it differentiates your product as a branding marketing approach, that was a part of the radio industry that wasn't, that there was very little expertise in, or very little thought around, little thought. And that didn't mean to say people didn't understand how to brand, but it was actually the connection between the logo and the brand and what you actually did on the air. That wasn't there. The creativity was something that I thought. I mean, the reason I'm still living in this country is I love it. I love the humor. I love the thinking. I love the language. I admire the ability. There's a guy called Nicholas Tresillian, who was one of our board directors, who could turn a phrase. And I can remember travelling with him to Budapest when we were looking for a license there, and we were at dinner, and I said something ridiculous, and he managed to give me some feedback in a way that felt so good but was actually so cutting. So I think in terms of creativity, clearly it was there. As you say, it was the environment that didn't allow people to have focus, and it was right. I mean, you know, it is, here you are, here's your 3 hours, you do what you like. Or the other side of that spectrum. So there's a lot of freedom for radio stations, for managers, for presenters, lots and lots of freedoms, which is fantastic. However, the industry was consolidating and big business got into it, and they just wanted to understand that there was some consistency. What that did for people who liked the freedom was that was difficult. It was like, well, I used to be able to choose my own records and now I can't. And where there was talent, that was fine. But a lot of the time it was actually laziness on some stations, particularly the smaller ones. You'd have a 22-year-old choosing songs for an audience that were mainly mums at home with kids. So it's pretty obvious that there needed to be some management of it. But I think from my point of view, you know, if you think about the GWR people, there's a drive and determination in them, but there's also a level of intelligence and approach. Ralph was always a journalist at heart, and he was always battling between, you know, I want these people to have radio the way I used to do it, which was the freedoms, but I know that we need to get a result. Steve's an intelligent broadcaster and a programmer at heart. He always has been. But at the end of the day, it's about how do we actually achieve the result that we need to achieve, because people have invested with us. People have given us their money to buy Trent FM and, you know, Herald FM and all the other radio stations. And we'd like you to give us a bit more money back for the money that we've lent you, please. So there's a reality there, which as we get a bit older and wiser, we understand. And then there's the approach. How did we approach it? And I think in the early days, we approached it, on a one-on-one scenario, people would say these guys are okay. However, if you didn't get a chance to have one-on-one conversations, you could be forgiven for reading the radio magazine as it was then. It was a conduit for people who didn't want to be a part of it. And that's fine. And I think I can see the era of GWR, and I can see it in various phases. The phase where we just went in and turned things around quickly, and people that were a part of that thought it was amazing, people that weren't didn't. Then we got a bit, and I'm generalizing, so then I think we got a bit sure of ourselves. And then when the Chiltern stations came along, I think that was a difficult acquisition. I think it was termed a hostile acquisition from that point of view. That made it difficult when you went and talked to people inside.
Better music, less chat. FM 103 Horizon, a better music mix for Milton Keynes.
That was both an era of, look, we know what we're doing, but they were very successful stations in their own right. Some of them have got a bit tired, and you know, in the inevitable sort of, you go from a peak and then you start to drift off. And we became involved in them, and there was a lot of pride in the people that had worked there, a lot of the managers, and didn't want this horrible corporate radio group, who were famous for providing training and development for people, help people begin their careers. And there's a lot of people nowadays who will quietly say thanks for all that coaching and stuff. And I think then we then had to learn a lot about being able to operate differently. And that's, for me, my personal journey changed around that time as well, because I then sort of recognised that I couldn't drive around the countryside shouting into a hands-free, you know, mobile phone saying, why is that promo being played there and why is that sweeper in that place, to actually saying, you know, this is so big you can't run it from the center. So that's where we began to change our approach. And that was sort of mid-90s. So that was only 3 or 4 years. It wasn't very long. And I had one of those epiphanies where a guy called Simon Cooper had brought in Allied Dunbar, which were pension providers. And that had been around the mis-selling of pension stage. So they needed to do a lot of training and development, governance of their own sales staff. And they said, well, we're doing this, you know, we're in Swindon, how about you, we come along and teach you how to coach talent. What are you guys going to do about teaching us to coach? We deal with, you're dealing with, you sell pensions, for God's sake. Anyway, we went along, they convinced us to at least have a go. We went along to the Allied Dunbar training facility, which is just outside Swindon, and he sat there, arms folded, and, you know, he could tell, the trainer could tell, the guy called Viv Miles, he could tell. He said, so what's going on with you guys? He said, well, you know, we are in a pension provider's place. You're going to teach us about coaching talent. And he said, look outside. And we looked outside. There's a car park there. What do you see? And he said, well, I see Black Thunders and all these other cars that the people have driven in. And what else do you see? Well, I see a few Porsches and a few, you know, German cars. And okay, so which ones are yours and which ones belong to the salespeople that work for us? So we have to coach people to improve their performance from earning £650,000 a year to earning £750,000. So from that moment, it became, okay, we will shut up and just listen here. And that was the beginning of what I would call a coaching approach. So it's leading and working with people based on coaching. And there are many horror stories out of GWR where people have to write reports about what went well and what went less well. But it was an approach that, you know, you'll hear a lot more today in successful companies about learning organization. What did we do that worked? What didn't we do? But the key was the ownership of the development and the ownership of getting better and performance sat with the individual as opposed to the manager. And that's where the big shift for me became. It wasn't actually me that needed to worry about whether Trent FM was rating or Southern FM. It was Dick Stone. It was his job. And that meant a shift in approach. And some of my colleagues will say, well, where's the old director gone, and what's this other bloke doing here? And, you know, and I had to go through a few years of learning the difference between being clear and being direct and then asking a lot more questions. So what are you going to do about this? So you can frustrate colleagues by being too direct. You can frustrate colleagues by asking them a question and making them think hard about what they need to do for their issue. And that's probably been that was the beginning of a journey about shifting an approach of how you operate, but also led me to sort of where I am today, doing lots of different things.
We've seized this transmitter on behalf of the people of Gloucestershire. Radio revolution has started.
Дайте мне один чемодан.
Prepare yourself for a totally different kind of radio station starting Saturday.
I'm really conscious of people putting a lot of effort in to make their radio station successful. No one comes to work to have a station that doesn't perform. So I think sometimes people come to work without realizing it, and they're doing it for themselves rather than for the greater good. But that's different. Our job was at the time to look at the radio station and work at how we could improve its audience performance. And that is difficult. You know, for the people that agreed, the people that got benefits out of that approach, that's quite easy. And, you know, those that didn't, I mean, I have a great deal of empathy. I really understand. But we happened to be the first. We weren't the only ones. There's a lot of other successful companies who were turning around radio stations as well. But we were the first that did it with a lot of radio stations, you know, buying radio stations. And it was the buying of the radio stations and the taking over that got people vexed, and that you're not listening to us. And in actual fact, there was a lot of listening. But if a station's performing so poorly, frankly, it's not that difficult to be able to say, what is it we need to do to improve it? Where the trickier parts is in latter years, when we were buying radio assets and those stations were doing well. Orchard was a radio station. I remember going down there, Steve Orchard said to me, you know, whatever you do, don't fuck it up, because it was performing brilliantly well. And by that stage, we'd had enough experience of buying stations, turning them around, bringing them into the thinking, giving them lots and lots of resource. I mean, you know, the unspoken thing, a lot of stations had no resource at all. and we were pumping money into them because you had to pump money into them for them to succeed. So this wasn't asset stripping. This was very much, even the smaller stations would have two Black Thunders, promotional vehicles, a marketing budget, because we knew that's what you needed to do to be able to get the audience up fast in order for us to be able to sell advertising to advertisers. We knew the plan, but we also loved the business. I wasn't that interested in the whether that particular artist was playing or not playing. What I was interested in is, are we playing our audience's favourite songs? So, you know, there's no question I missed out on music that I used to love because it became something that you knew you needed to do. So on the other end, we had record companies we were trying to deal with. And, you know, in the early days, I think that my approach was, we just won't speak to them. And of course, I learned over time that's not a way to build a partnership. And so the record labels were not very happy. But in time, I learnt. And they also realised that the industry was changing, that they weren't able to just buy their way onto a playlist, which makes it hard when the biggest radio companies like Capital were still doing that and we weren't. And we were the small players. So it was a case of, you know, who the hell are you? But we knew we needed to approach it that way in order to sort of make a clean break. This is how we have to operate. If it's a great song, we'll play it because we're dictated by our audiences. I mean, the guys at Key 103, Mark Story and Keith Pringle, were using BPR research as well. I think they were in the early days of it. And I'd been using it for many, many years beforehand. So we sort of, I suppose, we were on a parallel paths. And I think research, for me, is a most amazing tool that anyone could have. When you've got a crystal ball, it's not very clear, but it, you know, like any piece of data, it's the analysis that is where the real value is. So you get data, which is information, and then you've got to turn it into insight. And I think that's where I think we were very successful. We were able to, because we work with great consultants like Peter Don and Bill Clemens and those guys who were standing on the shoulders of others before them around the world, and they would say, this is what these numbers might mean. And over years, you look at a piece of information, you get some insight, you try something, that does work or it doesn't work. And there's no question that if you follow any research slavishly, then you become homogenized. However, like the current debate with the BBC, you've got to be big enough that you can allow your innovation space to grow. So we were successful enough we could try some new things. So we used a lot of audience research. But it's very difficult to research, well, it was for us as media companies, to research something that people didn't understand. You can only research people's opinions of what they already know. So you have to still have innovation. You have to steal the values of British creativity, of our own creativity, and try those things. And I think the pendulum swings one way. You don't ever use research. All of a sudden it comes along and everyone follows it slavishly. I don't believe we did. But I think from others' perspectives, if you've never used research, then anyone even thinking about it looks like they're following it slavishly. People stopped using research for a long time because they weren't making decisions against it. And now, slowly but surely, radio companies are realizing that we've got to still do some research because we've still got to understand what people's tastes are. We can't just rely on Spotify or the digital streaming services to tell us what people love. We've got to look at their attitudes. That is, you know, New Zealand, the US, the UK, Australia, all those countries were at the forefront of doing research. And radio was at the forefront of doing research ahead of television. Television weren't doing the sort of research we were. The BBC weren't doing the sort of research that commercial radio was doing. They did not too long afterwards, and their quality research with the money they've got is very high. Record companies followed on by doing research, all coming from radio, which was the first media in the UK and the world to use research to understand their audiences.
Here at Trent FM, we need your help. We're building a brand new kind of radio station for Nottingham. Call the new Trent FM listener line on Nottingham 506-770 and give us your suggestions about the kind
of... What always strikes me is that even at the time, people were saying it's not like the good old days. And in 2016, I hear people say it's not like the good old days in the 90s and noughties. It's like, okay. But I think if I remember back fondly to those times, it's the amount of fun that we had when we put investment into stations. You know, one of the things I'm probably most proud of in those GWR days was the beginning of Breakfast Show Boot Camp, where we stole the idea from the US and we brought all of our breakfast shows together. You know, this cost us hundreds of thousands of pounds to do, and we brought breakfast shows together because we knew that that they were, you know, the drivers of our business, the engine room of our business. And we would have weekends together, and there was lots of fun, there was lots of learning, and I had to call it learning because that was the way I get the money out of the company. But we had a lot of fantastic weekends, and it really showed our breakfast talent just how valuable they were to us. When I came to this part of the world, Michelle came with me. We came together, although she did come later. We were both in Dublin together. We were both in Bristol together. And Michelle at 38, actually it was earlier, it was 36, she contracted breast cancer. So for nearly 4 years, she died at 39, nearly 4 years, we were managing that. And in the phase of sort of GWR, it was the last 2 years of Michelle's life were when we were moving to creation. So I had to reapply for my own position as we were moving into a restructure, getting ready for that. So, because the group program director position was not there. But, you know, I can't speak for anybody else except myself and Michelle in that time. You know, it was just awful. Her illness was awful. And you know, forget me. I mean, it was her the one that had to go through the pain of the fear of not knowing what's happening. I mean, you know, if anyone listening to this is thinking, I don't know what's happening here, I'm unsure about something, you imagine that, where at the end of it, one of the options is death. You know, that's a pretty frightening prospect. And we were living in the UK, and Michelle comes from Tasmania. And so what's the first thing you want to do when you've got this problem? You want to go back to home, what you consider to be your home. What does that mean? What did that mean for both of us? What did that mean for me? So the psychological roller coaster of cancer is arguably much more difficult than the physical aspects of it, as awful as they are. You know, they say it takes a significant life experience to shift your values and your beliefs. And certainly that was one where I don't think before, I was so focused on career that, you know, I have two children now. I don't think I would have done that before, because I thought I wouldn't be a decent enough father because I'd be too focused on a career. And I realised then that, having looked after Michelle, and I say that very loosely, having been a part of that time where your focus is divided, you realise you can. And, you know, I was just an idiot. Of course I could bring up two great children and all that sort of stuff and have a great career. You know, millions of other people have. My friends and my family now know this story, that, you know, in the last year, it was so awful, it was difficult. It was, for us it was anyway. But we were, you know, at a period of time there, I was spending a month in the UK and then a month in Tasmania, and I was working overnight in Tasmania to do the job here. And in the end, it just didn't work. Steve Orchard and Patrick Taylor at the time and Ralph were obviously fantastic and all that sort of stuff. And I knew that was going to be fine. Michelle did, you know, the cancer came back. We thought it had gone away. The cancer came back. And in the last year of her life, she came back to live in Bristol. And you know, she was away for about 6 months treatment in Australia and then came back to live. And we were, you know, I suppose you could say we fell in love again, if you like, after a pretty awful. And she looked $1 million. She was in great form, as people with cancer will tell you. And then, you know, it was the last 8 weeks of her life where it became apparent. We knew, obviously, that it wasn't going to go away. And then we had to manage that last period of time. So people say that cancer is a gift, and that for probably most people we won't understand, but it is. You can never think like that because it's too hard to sort of manage this idea of a gift together with the reality of the pain that, you know, that you're going through physically and mentally. But it changed you know, my perspective on lots of things. It actually brought the two of us then together in a way that it wouldn't have happened if that experience hadn't happened. You know, it made a lot of changes. You know, I've got a new family, I've got children, and that is, you know, there's, you know, you can link all those things together. We'd always known, and I think the whole industry knew, that it was synergistic for Capital and GWR to come together. And from my point of view, I remember, you know, Ralph's the CEO, Steve's the chief operating officer, Wendy's the finance director, and, you know, I'm along with the sales director and group program director, sort of, I suppose, in some ways, having to make the business ready for that eventual merger when the legislation changed. So we spent 2 years before that legislation change, which allowed us to make the merger happen, getting our business, GWR, ready for merger. And that was a very clear goal. And part of that was when creation came along an opus where we actually we changed the dynamics of the business, a big structural change and a big culture change, where we said we're going to be ready for merger because we want to be in the best position to be the team that helps deliver a new enlarged radio business. We wanted to be the people that were having lunch rather than were lunch, if that makes sense. And we talked about that openly. People knew. So any decisions we made were around that context, getting ourselves ready for that time. And we operated very differently. We had big culture change. And I think that was, from my perspective, and I'm sure others will have a different view, the difference between the capital's approach to getting ready for merger and ours over the 2 years. We included a culture change where we said to people, we have to operate differently. We now work on a customer-supplier relationship. And it was the first time, you know, led by very much by me, to say that we as programmers are a supplier to our sales house. And that was a really big shift. But it also meant that our technology team were a supplier of services to our sales house and to our programmers. And accounts were a supplier of services as opposed to telling us what we could spend and not. And that culture change was significant in meaning that we could actually make the structural change work. You know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And in that case, is a great example of it. Ironically, at that time, over the 2 years, the bigger stations were able to handle that culture change and that structural change much more successfully than the smaller ones. The smaller stations really did need local leadership. Sweeping generalization, but the caliber of people you can get to lead a small business in a small market is much more difficult. And so therefore, a general manager or a managing director who's leading a small team in a local market is actually more valuable. So we learnt that on the way through. So when the merger happened, from my point of view, you know, it was a merger of equals. You know, there's a lot of talent on the other side at Capital. Of course, we would think that we would have the edge and we were the ones that should be leading it. But in order to get the merger to happen, as I'm sure that you've heard before, we had two of everything, which of course doesn't work. And we had two chief executives. I know the titles reflected a different setup, two chief operating officers, two group program directors. We had two of everything. It was wonderful. But on paper, our you know, corporately, we were one, but we were two operating, and that lasted for 6 months. And then the reality of what needed to happen, and that always happens around the board table. That decision is made at the top, and then the consequences of those decisions filter throughout the business. But this wasn't about who's the most talented, because as we merged together, we went through the whole recruitment agencies and, you know, assessment checks and all the sort of stuff that you do with big corporates. I mean, this was a £737 million merger. The frustration I had, it was frustrating because we had different perspectives. I think the biggest frustration was that people didn't trust you. People didn't realize what you could do. And I'm sure that was the same everywhere with other colleagues. But I don't think David, because David was in charge, you know, frankly, my loyalty is to my colleagues, but it doesn't really matter for me. If this guy's in charge, then he's in charge. So I would see David and say, well, this is what's going on. And I get a sense of you think I'm from the other side. And I've always found that really weird. It doesn't matter. You know, I'm happy to, if I disagree with your strategy, then I'll argue with you, but you're the boss. That's the way it goes. And if it doesn't work and I'm not right, then, you know, I'll go. But so that was the frustration. We were saying, this is what we ought to do. We knew it was right. I mean, it was difficult because the money issues were always a big issue. And it was always about, you know, well, any decision that spends money over £500 would have to be dealt with, you know, around the executive table. And we'd come from a culture where we respect, you've got a budget, you stay within that budget and you make your decisions. So, well, and, you know, when that was an approach that Capital did when they needed to get control of spend, and that's fair enough. That approach is not right or wrong. It's just an approach. So there's an example of a different approach, which is frustrating. And that for me, it was a lack of trust. We're good at what we do. Trust us. And in the end, the board had to make a decision as to which way they wanted to go in terms of leading the business. And, you know, it turned out to be the GWR management team that led the business. And you sort of always wonder whether, you know, whether it would have been easy walking away at that stage or staying. So that was a significant moment. But we were, you know, looking back, we wanted to play with the big train set. Well, I certainly did, that's for sure.
London's 95.8 Capital FM. Good afternoon, a beautiful evening in the capital. This is Foxy on Drive Time.
The day that the time that it happened, the really amazing thing about how you operate on sort of two levels, because if you remember the tsunami, the Radio 8. Now, we had agreed to merge. We were at the planning stages of the merger. lots and lots of conversation, who's going to do what and all the rest of it. And Radio 8 happened. So Keith is the program director of Capital, and Nick, I'm the group program director of GWR. We're about to merge. This event's happening. Mark Story's there.
I asked my colleagues from the all of the various radio groups, commercial radio groups, to come to a meeting last Friday morning at 8 in the morning, and they all turned up on time. And we sat in the room for about 10 minutes and said, look, we want to do this. We want you to close.
And I'm sitting there. And, of course, for years I'm the junior woodchuck at the table because that's the regional dude. And it could be that in about 2 months' time, because this was over the Christmas, in May when we do merge, what's my role and who would be sitting around the stage? So that was quite amazing for all of us to go, we are here today, but in 3 months' time, this is all going to look very different. And I was walking around the Capital Radio building, and I was put somewhere in a back office somewhere, thinking to myself, that's interesting, when other people were sitting in different parts of the building. But, it gave me an opportunity to just watch. I mean, all those times when that happens, you just watch. But what we did do on that Radio Aid, which was a fantastic event, and I'm very, very proud of being a part of that, that was a really inclusive, and I'm pleased about the role that, in terms of getting people together. Famous line, I won't say it, from Keith Pringle was when we were trying to get, when do we do this? When should we do this? Was over. Well, I made the suggestion, look, let's just do it, pick a date, because if we pick a date 8 weeks away, then it'll be done in 8 weeks. If we pick a date in 10 days, we'll do it in 10 days. So we all went, yeah, let's do it. We'll do it in 10 days. Who cares? We'll just focus on it. So we had a deadline, and Keith was trying to get two very, very well-known stars to come and join. And their agent said, oh, no. And they couldn't get a response from him. So he finally rang up and says, what are you waiting for? A bigger wave? Anyway, it was a sense of the time, and Keith and Mark together, and of course everyone knows the Keith and Mark history, they worked brilliantly well in producing that event. They were masters to watch. They were absolutely the right people in the right place. They've got history, heritage, people knew them. And for me, in the context of what was happening in the merger, it was best for me to sit back and watch these guys do what they did. They were amazing, and they produced an amazing event, supported by the rest of the industry.
Time now to cross over to Mr. Liam Gallagher. He's going to perform an acoustic track exclusively for Radio 8. Here we go.
You're gonna be the one that saves me.
When the GWR management team began to run the combined entity of GCAP, this was a pinnacle of my career. I'd been working towards this all of my career, to be the most senior programmer in the industry. It was an ambition. I changed from being quite direct and in control to sort of working a different approach, a leadership approach that was different, because you can't run all these stations yourself. Capital came along, and there was a question about, look, everything that happens to Capital has an impact on the rest of the business. It's like an inverted pyramid, Capital being the pointy end and the rest of it. Ironically, all of the stations outside of London made all the money, and the stations inside London didn't. Trent FM was much more profitable than Classic FM. And, and of course, like all this, how you account for it and all the rest of it. But the question about what do we do with Capital was difficult. And, Keith was running Capital with Nick. Johnny Vaughan was there in breakfast. But it was an interesting, it was probably one of the few times where I disagreed with, Steve and Ralph. And, of course, what happens is that everyone's brain gets sucked into Capital. So I'm running all the radio stations outside London, and Steve's, if you like, as chief operating officer, sort of focused, and with a group programming background, focused on London. But of course, I would get involved in the strategic discussions and research on London stations and Classic and Capital and all the rest of it. And there was a moment where things were happening, and Nottingham would be probably the station that was most innovative, the station that was doing things, the Joe and Twiggy breakfast show with Dick leading that team, Dick Stone. They would always be trying to do things. How do we? Because they wanted to show those bastards in Bristol that they were much better than them, and there was always a healthy rivalry between Trent and GWR in Bristol, which is fantastic because our best programmers were in those stations. But there was a healthy rivalry in the sense that these guys were a part of the team. We're all they worked as individual teams, but then when we came together, they were one team. What struck me one day when there was a conversation and said, what they're doing in Nottingham is what we should be doing in London during this Christmas break. The creativity, the innovation that they're putting on the air, the stunts that they're doing, we should be doing in London. And the comment back, and I won't say where the comment came from, but the comment back was, but London's different. And I knew then that the GWR team were so focused on London that they'd, you know, that I think we'd forgotten. Now, it's one comment, and it doesn't make an attitude, because that wasn't that. But it was a moment where we were under such pressure with London stations that kind of you can believe the. Now, in the past life, when someone said London's different, we'd all go, that's bollocks. We've run Classic FM. We know that that's not the case. The principles are the same. It was Steve Orchard and Ralph Bernard that brought pop music radio principles to Classic FM and turned that into, with Darren Henley, of course, and turned that into the most amazing, successful radio station by using that. So I think, with the benefit of hindsight, that's the sort of thing that we could have been faster on attacking. You know, there was a sort of a loose sort of conversation around, should I go and run Capital at one time? And I just sort of thought, I've always wanted to be, my career was to be ambition. And I didn't do it. My career ambition was to be a group program director of the biggest radio group. I'd achieved that. Capital is the one we need to put some focus on. And I know what I'd do. And I've only told a few people what I would have actually done, root and branch, if I was in charge. I tussle between should I have done, but, one shouldn't have regrets. I didn't, because I didn't think I'd be allowed to do the things that I would want to have done. That is, when I look at what Global and the guys have done as a private business, they're all the things that, GWR would have liked to have done, GCAP would have liked to have done. But as far as Capital, so the biggest story for me is as a personal one, whereas, what should I have believed enough in my own strategy for Capital that I should have said, come on guys, give me the keys, let me get on with this. And they would have, Ralph and Steve would have said, okay. But I'm not so sure they would have allowed me to do exactly the things I wanted to do that I believe should have been done.
I love Capital.
Hey, how's it going? This is Jack Johnson.
This your boy Neo.
This is Kylie.
Hey, this is Mariah Carey on Capital.
Well, it's interesting because my daughter was born and we were on a conference call and I was all very excited and I was saying to Ralph, I've named my daughter Jessica Alice. And he said, well, let's see, that's the names of my two daughters, which I sort of half, I remembered, of course. I went, oh, well, I promise you, I'm not trying to suck up here. Ha, ha, ha. Joke. And he went on to tell us that he was moving on. He was resigning. And I knew that there was pressure. And I knew that, Ralph's a good operator. He gave a lot of people a lot of rope. He's a very loyal man. But he's got a view of radio. He's got a view of how things should be done. He listens a lot to people he trusts, and he does trust good people. And I think he just got to a point where there'd been a change of chair, there'd been a change of people around the board. Things weren't moving, and people just thought these guys have been running this thing for long enough, and it's time for a change. And I think, depending on how you measure things, the types of changes that needed to happen, it's not just one thing. But you. Ralph decided, as he said publicly, that he could have won that battle, but he wasn't up for it. He thought it was time to make a change. And of course, subsequently, when Frew became the CEO, same thing again as David. I was okay. Frew, you're the boss. What do you want to do? Her approach was, I want my own people. So Paul Jackson was then running Capital, and he then became the quasi-group program director, and Steve left. We all knew it was coming, so we had lots of conversations with the HR director, who was also a very good friend of ours, who was saying, you guys are going, thanks very much. And it was all very amicable, as these things are. Again, for me, the big thing is around trust. If we say we're going in this direction, the skill and the capability. But after 14 years in one organization, albeit in different roles, it's time for a change for people. And, as it happened, it was fortuitous. 3 months later, Global took a pop at GCAP, which meant that the shares that I had bought for myself over the years were worth a bit more than they were. So thank you, Frew, for that. Frew had a different strategy for digital than GCAP. That's her strategy is probably proving less robust today than it was then. But at the time, that's the decision you take at the time, and fair play for her to take it. It wasn't sad. It was the thing about moving on is less about the fact you've got to move on. It's actually how people remember you. It's actually how history gets rewritten. And you look at all the ratings numbers of stations today in London, particularly Capital, particularly the share number, the share of market. and the resources that are thrown at those things. And I think what, you know, I've said it before and I've said it many times to many people, what Global have done with that network has been phenomenal. And they're doing what most of us would have liked to have done but didn't have the courage under public, you know, being a publicly quoted company, or because the regulators wouldn't have liked it so much in the early days. Radio is healthier in the UK. I know that lots of anoraks would disagree. Radio is healthier in the UK than anywhere in the world because of private ownership. Bauer are approaching it from a different way. Global are approaching it from their way. You know, I'm not talking about how people are running their companies. I'm talking about the consumer propositions and what it's like to appreciate their products and services. You know, I think they've done an amazing job.
If you watch STV tonight, you will see our television commercial, which tells you about Capital FM, featuring Rihanna, Black Eyed Peas, Usher, those sort of
things. So you're the kind of guy, you can just pick up the phone and ask them to do this for you, can't you?
Well, I've been in the business a long time.
Since GCAP, I went to work for a public service broadcaster in Australia, and I had 3 years at SBS, which is the equivalent of Channel 4. I ran their radio division, which was audio and languages. So we produced news content in 67 different languages. I managed to play in television. I sat around the top table with the TV guy. I mean, it's a TV company with a radio arm, as we radio people know. I was determined to learn a lot more about television and to demonstrate again the skills that radio people have, because television is becoming a lot more like radio, 24/7. You've got to turn things around faster. Media is becoming democratized, so I got to understand a lot more of the language of television, and, you know, like to think brought some expertise to that team around fast turnaround and how to lead a creative team in a much more nimble way. Our team was given the opportunity to create television in Mandarin language. We created new radio services, music services. We did a lot of things because they had confidence that we could deliver. And I learned a lot about the rigor of public service broadcasting, the planning that's needed because you're using taxpayers' funds. So my big area of interest in today's world is change, how you actually lead change and how you bring about results through change in a way that's safe for people and for businesses and organizations and shareholders. And we used a change methodology, which helped us, and we did a lot more work on planning. I mean, I was sitting on my hands frustrated because we had to do so much planning in order to get approval, in order to go ahead. But that planning really taught me a lot about the rigor that you need to be able to provide something that's robust. And that is, that's been a fantastic piece of learning. And I bring that together with the nimbleness of commercial media, together with the rigor of public service broadcasting and planning, bring that to my clients today, my non-media clients and media clients, in working out what their strategic direction is, where they want to go, how they're going to get there, and importantly, how they're going to implement their plan in a way that doesn't damage the business or the people inside it.
SBS Chill across Australia. Chill.
So I've been in Bristol for 15 years. I've done 2 years in Dublin, so 17 years away. I'm much more European than I am. I'm an Aussie, but my parents are Dutch, so what am I? Citizen of the world is cliche. My wife, who's English, and we've got young kids, after 3 years, just couldn't get over homesickness. So, you know, living a life in Australia with young kids, fantastic. And she loved it, and it was wonderful, it was great. However, if birthdays, Christmases, family times, you feel a homesickness. And a lot of people who do who emigrate go through it. We decided to come back. I was really unhappy about leaving my job. So we had lots of conversations over lots of glasses of wine. But, you know, I just knew that bringing the family up as one unit was more important. And so we, you know, I suppose I made the decision in the end that, yes, that's what we needed. That was the best interest. And I love living here. I've lived in Bristol. I've got friends. I've got connections. And I now live just outside of Oxford. I love it. I'm in London all the time. I'm seeing people, and we're building a new life and a new business. In coming back, I decided that I could put up a shingle and say, hey, I'm a radio consultant, but there are a lot of really smart, clever people out there that are doing that already. And I do some radio consulting. I work with a breakfast show on their development, and much more about their inner talent and their curiosity and their storytelling, rather than, you know, what's the benchmark feature at 8:10. I can do that, but it's the other stuff that's more interesting, I think. I work with some media companies, the BBC, ITN, on facilitating their various activities that they're doing. So much more of a team coaching role, and I work with them on their strategic direction on certain areas. I work with non-media companies on their strategy. So I'm, I suppose, a management consultant, you could say, but very much on what's the direction of your business. And my company's called Blank White Page, and I work with a business partner, David and Jane, and we focus on owner-operators, entrepreneurs, people who run their own businesses, because it can be pretty solitary in that space. Who do you talk to? So we provide a consulting service and a coaching service. And I started a master's degree in coaching and behavioral change, because when working with big corporates on executive coaching and leadership coaching, they inevitably want, what are your credentials? Saying, well, I've spent 25 years working with DJ talent. It works to an extent, but it doesn't have the same as you know, you've studied this. So I've spent 3 years learning the academic foundations of what we would do instinctively when we're working with great talent, creative talent. And it's been amazing. It's completely shifted my perspective. It's another phase of life. People call them the soft skills, and actually they're the hardest skills to learn. And if, you know, most people, when they say there's something wrong with their business or their organization, they'll inevitably talk about not being able to get things done the way they want them done. So I've become somebody who likes to learn the academic understanding about things, which is a big shift from leaving school at 16 and becoming an apprentice carpenter to sitting inside a university lecture hall learning about the psychology of talent. I think I'd like to be remembered as being capable and trustworthy. I think it's probably the thing for me is that capable at what he was doing able to focus on what needed to be done and didn't get sucked into the gossip of things. I think that was capable and trustworthy. Oh yes, there's one thing I want to say. Ralph and Steve keep talking about the fact that they came up with Planet Rock. They didn't. Thank you.